You are listening to another Voice of Freedom broadcast, financed through the free will donations of listeners like yourself. I'm Ernst Sundl, your host and moderator. The opinions expressed by our guests or in editorials and stories are always those of the originators. We believe that personal opinions freely expressed are not a danger to any democratic society. We don't have to agree with any or all of the opinions expressed by others. We owe it to ourselves, however, to listen, to evaluate, and to possibly learn something new or different in the process. You may reach us at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1, telephone 1-416-922-9850. And now we have another interesting program for you. I'm Ernst Sundl with another Voice of Freedom program. We are going to discuss a famous book, The Transfer Agreement, subtitled The Untold Story of the Secret Pact Between the Third Reich and Jewish Palestine. The author is Edwin Black. The publisher is Macmillan of New York and London. And we left off in our last broadcast about a protest organized by Rabbi Steven Weiss, and it says here on page 68 the following, that there was a photograph showing Rabbi Steven Weiss with some congressmen or supporters in Congress in the United States, published in the Völkische Beobachter, which was the National Socialist Party's official organ. And it says it was a picture of Steven S. Weiss standing beside two Congress supporters. Late the night before, Goebbels wrote privately that the struggle against international Jewry, quote, will be a fight to the finish, end of quote. April 1st was therefore day one. The Nazis had launched their war against the Jews, mobilizing all of Germany. The Jews would launch their war against the Nazis, mobilizing all the world. Anti-Hitler boycotts, protest marches and meetings were now in store. Germany was to be isolated politically, economically, and even culturally, until she cast off her Nazi leadership. Germany was to be taught another bitter lesson. That was written by Edwin Black in this book called The Transfer Agreement. And I want to pause here for a moment and say to you, remember, this was the first year of Adolf Hitler's assumption to power. The first year. There was no Auschwitz. There was no Majdanek, no Treblinka. There was no Dachau, no Mauthausen, no Bergen-Belsen. And already, Edwin Black says that April the 1st was therefore day one in this international struggle, that the Nazis launched their war against the Jews, mobilizing all of Germany, and that the Jews would launch their war against the Nazis, mobilizing all the world. Anti-Hitler boycotts, protest marches and meetings were now in store. Germany was to be isolated politically, economically, even culturally, until she cast off her Nazi leadership. Germany was to be taught another bitter lesson. I want to be very, very sure that you who are listening to this program understand what is being said here. Nobody was gassed, even if you believe in the gas chamber story. Nobody was gassed by that time. Jews were not yet in internment camps. Jews were not treated as enemy aliens yet. And yet, Germany was to be isolated. Now, Germany is a country that lives by exports. Germany dies without exports. So the German government, whether they be Nazis or not Nazis, as even today under Helmut Kohl found out during the Operation Desert Storm, when the Allied media, the American media especially, was rife with anti-German stories, saying that the German incurable mindset were financing and arming Saddam Hussein. Remember these stories? Whom the Allied and the American media called the kind of Hitler in the desert. And guess what happened? The German Chancellor and his regime, totally democratic, no anti-Jewish program, constantly bowing and scraping to these international forces, found that $1.5 billion worth of cars $1.5 billion worth of Mercedes and BMWs and Audis were not sold in the United States, and they linked, many people in Germany linked it directly to the anti-German campaign. That's a reality of the 1990s. So, even without Adolf Hitler, Germany is definitely susceptible to economic pressure. Let me turn to the Zionist solution, chapter 7, in Edwin Black's book, The Transfer Agreement. Here is what he says. In Paris, hundreds of German Jewish refugees strained charitable organizations to the limit. It was the same in Czechoslovakia and in Poland, which counted at least 3,000 fleeing Jews, and Switzerland, where at least 6,000 had entered, in Belgium, where thousands of Jews fled over the hills to freedom. Many chased by the rifle fire of Reich border guards, and all this in just the first 3 or 4 days following the Nazi anti-Jewish boycott, which of course was responded by the Jewish boycott. There's always this dispute, who boycotted whom first? Non-bordering European states such as Spain and Portugal and even England also felt the drama of escape, as each new ship yielded more desperate German Jewish citizens. Within 2 weeks of April 1st, more than 10,000 German Jews had escaped and were now in need of food, clothing, organization, jobs, etc. as a basis for existence. No Nazi claim of domestic affairs could any longer stand. The crisis was indeed international. Germany's persecution of its Jews was openly at the doorstep of the world. Newspaper and radio reports from Germany were now bettered by new evidence. Men, women and children, homeless, hungry and clutching the remnants of their lives in small bags. As in previous emergencies, the world Jewish community reacted with political agitation against the oppressive force. But this fight would be different. It would not be waged so much by those with access to high office as by ordinary men and women whose great weapon lay in jingling in their coin purses. The front lines would be in the dime stores and the cinemas, in the camera shops and in the haberdasheries, where every person wielded a mighty power, the simple power to reject. The boycott was the long gun whose shell could reach from London or Detroit to Hamburg or Munich. Therefore, local Jewish communities and national associations would not suffice. People would need to be unified in a far-flung, all-encompassing economic war against the Third Reich. An international Jewish body would be needed, and in 1933 there existed only one that maintained a worldwide organization and enjoyed the popular following and political access to the anti-Nazi boycott movement demanded. That body was the Zionist organizations. Yet in the eyes of Zionists, the outrages of Hitler were nothing unexpected. Zionist ideology predicted periodic Jewish oppression in even the most enlightened lands of the diaspora, that is, the communities of Jewish dispersion. And he goes on saying that the rise of Hitler was therefore seen by the Zionists simply as the latest anti-Semitic episode. But this time things were different. In a macabre sense, things were ideal. I repeat, in a macabre sense, things were ideal. The German Jews were not impoverished Russian peasants or lower-class Polish merchants with few valuables. These German Jews were solidly middle-class. They possessed land, homes, furnishings, shares of stock. They were lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists, artists, civil servants. They owned not storefronts, but department store chains. They owned not pawn shops, but major commercial banks. These men and women who had no place in the German Reich would find an indispensable place in the Jewish nation. From their dispossession would come repossession. Behold, Israel was waiting within the borders of the Third Reich. I could not put it more eloquently. I love this line. From their dispossession would come repossession. Behold, Israel was waiting within the borders of the Third Reich. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, If Ernst Zündel were to say that, if I did not quote you from Edwin Black's book, The Transfer Agreement, page 72, the chapter on the Zionist movement and the Zionist solution, you would think that some clever anti-Semite wrote this line, from their dispossession would come repossession. You know what repossession meant there? This is what we have been talking about on this whole series of discussions we had on reparations. That's what you could call it. From dispossession would come repossession. And that Israel was waiting within the borders of the Reich. Boy, this young man, prophetic statement, because that is exactly what had happened after the war. He goes on page 73, outlining what Zionism was. In the 1890s, after the pogroms of uncivilized Russia, end quote, and the Dreyfus prosecution in civilized France, quote, Theodor Herzl emerged as the leader of an international group of Jewish thinkers who saw a return to the Holy Land as the solution to Jewish persecution in Europe. Herzl, in 1895, had written a pamphlet entitled The Jewish State, an attempt at a modern solution to the Jewish question. Quote, the Jewish state, end of quote, originally written in German under the title Der Judenstaat, was an extraordinary work, mixing equal portions of genius and nonsense, human compassion and ruthless pragmatism, a keen sense of history, and an impressive utopian notion of the future. Der Judenstaat, quote, became the Bible of the Zionist movement. In his treatise, Herzl readily admits that there is a Jewish problem. Quote, wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers, end of quote. Herzl declares that the Jews themselves, quote, introduced, end of quote, anti-Semitism by their very presence. Quote, where it does not exist, it is carried by Jews in the course of their migrations. We naturally move to those places where there are not prosecuted, and there our presence produces persecution. This is the case in every country, end of quote. Thus Herzl declares that Jewish persecution is not an apparent facet of bigoted society, but a natural reaction to the appearance of a foreign group, namely the Jews. End of quote. These insightful words are to be found in a book by a Jewish author, Edwin Black, called The Transfer Agreement, on page 73. He continues, it is the natural Christian backlash in Herzl's view, not the Jewish religion, that makes the Jewish people a true and distinct nation. That nation, he declares, must procure itself a territory, establish sovereignty, and transfer its people. Herzl specifies Palestine as the ideal home for the Jewish nation if acquired under formal international guarantees. Herzl denigrates gradual colonization as mere infiltration, quote. Sure, once again, to simulate anti-Semitism, international supervision was prerequisite to any population transfer. So this is what he says is a precursor to this transfer agreement where these Jews left from Germany, Nazi Germany, to Israel. On page 74, he has a sentence which I think is worth repeating. He says, anti-Semitism, not religion, created the Jewish nation. Because so many writers have said that, for instance, the Catholic Church is the most anti-Semitic body ever created on the face of the earth and so on, which is utter nonsense. You know, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of Catholics throughout the ages haven't harbored a single anti-Jewish thought. So, on page 75, he says, the organized withdrawal of all Jews from Europe carried an obvious appeal, even an unintended justification for anti-Semites. As such, Zionism was as much a threat to comfortable middle-class Jews as anti-Semitism itself. Established Jewish communities insisted they were entitled to be treated like ordinary citizens of any country in which they lived. Herzl's answer to the expected resentment of the Jewish majority was simply to wait. Quote, great exertions will hardly be necessary to spur on the movement, end of quote. Quote, anti-Semites need only do what they did before, and then they will create a Jewish desire to emigrate where it did not previously exist, end of quote. So, Theodor Herzl, the formulator, the founding father of modern Zionism, basically, you could say, spawned or was very glad to have the help of the National Socialist Movement in Germany in order to people his land. He actually prophesied it. And during the 1920s, amid daily massacres on the Polish border and political uncertainty, eminent Zionist leader Max Nordau espoused a stark new concept, some called catastrophic Zionism. Nordau, a radical philosopher with a doomsday outlook, had been Herzl's closest ally in Zionism's founding years. In Herzl's dying moments in 1904, his followers insisted Nordau succeed him as the head of the Zionist movement, but Nordau refused, preferring to remain outside the upper echelon. At the 10th Zionist Congress in 1911, Nordau predicted if the Jewish Palestine were not granted soon, millions of Jews in Europe would be annihilated and by the emerging political forces. On page 78, he says, Zionist leadership had in fact refused to oppose the Nazi expulsion ideology from the outset. And yet, you know, it's interesting, today the worldwide Zionist movement constantly harms at this cruel policy by these Nazis again for having expelled all these Jews. And here is Edwin Black investigating this thing, and he says the Zionist leadership had in fact refused to oppose the Nazi expulsion ideology from the outset. Within 24 hours of Hitler's appointment, German Zionists finalized a recently discussed program called Youth Aliyah. Aliyah is the Hebrew term for immigration to Israel. Its literal translation is ascend. On the premise that there was no longer any future for Jews in Germany, Youth Aliyah organized youngsters to find a future in the Jewish homeland. So, but it was also a sign to the Nazis that Jews themselves were willing to organize their own expulsion. He says, and the Nazi theory of race, which humiliated every Jewish child, quickly became mandatory teaching in all classes. Youth Aliyah served a noble purpose in allowing young German Jews to grow up in dignity as part of a historic new future. But it also was a sign to the Nazis that Jews themselves were willing to organize their own expulsion. You see this confluence? I was so shocked in research into my trials, for my trials, and when Joseph Ginsburg, this Jewish scholar, said to me that there were camps for young Jews in Germany where they were taught to work as bricklayers, as stonemasons, as cabinet makers, and as carpenters. And one of these camps apparently was located in my own home province in Württemberg near Tübingen, where these young kids were taught for years like an apprenticeship program, and then they were sent off to Israel, where they undoubtedly helped in building the Jewish state. On page 78, Edwin Black goes on and he says, the Zionist acceptance of Jewish expulsion was not limited to the Germans. Zionist leaders worldwide saw Hitler's persecution as the fateful beginning. Even the defender of Jewish rights, as eminent as Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, quietly conceded the right of Jewish existence in Germany. Within a fortnight of the Führer's January 30th appointment, Justice Brandeis shocked Stephen Weiss by candidly declaring, quote, the Jews must leave Germany. There is no other way, end of quote. An astonished Rabbi Weiss asked, quote, how can 585,000 people be taken out of Germany? End of quote. Brandeis interrupted, quote, I would have the Jews out of Germany. They have been treated with deepest disrespect. I urge that Germany shall be free of Jews. Let Germany share the fate of Spain. No Jew must live in Germany, end of quote. So, Edwin Black goes on, Nazi leadership, of course, gleefully noted the Zionist acceptance of Jewish expulsion, even if it was clear that the concurrence was perverse, since the Nazis thought Jewish cultural destruction, the Zionists thought a Jewish renaissance. But concurrence or not, the Nazis regarded the Zionists as their enemy personified, and from the outset carried out a terror campaign against them in Germany. That's utter nonsense. That is utter nonsense, what he's saying here. Because on the one hand, he is saying that the Zionists were the agency by which the Germans were going to get rid of the Jews. And Joseph Ginzburg told me that Golda Meir and some other notable Zionists were hobnobbing with the German leadership, with senior bureaucrats of the Reich, in hotels in Berlin. I forget the name of the hotel, I would have to go back to my files, but he even mentioned what hotels they were staying in. And Dr. Joseph Goebbels sent a reporter down to Palestine who wrote in one of the Nazi newspapers, his own paper called Der Angriff, a whole series of articles, a Nazi in Palestina, which was a Nazi in Palestine. I've read the article with my own eyes. So there was no deadly animosity at that time, quote, at that time, between international Zionism and national socialism. The cooperation was total. As a matter of fact, I have heard from numerous reliable sources that it was a Zionist, I think Rabbi Leo Beck, who wanted to have the yellow star introduced as an identification mark for the Jews in Germany. And Dr. Goebbels was against it at the beginning. And other Germans said that it was stupid, that it was impolitic, that they shouldn't do it. And yet, apparently, it was an idea from that particular side. So, on page 79, Edwin Black says, but Zionism threatened status in Germany changed instantly following the March 25th meeting in Goering's office with Jewish leaders. It was after Kurt Blumenfeld's utterance that only the Zionists possess the international organization capable of stopping the anti-Nazi movement and that the Nazi view changed. From that moment on, the Third Reich realized it could exploit the Zionist movement against the Jews. At the same time, Zionists became convinced they could exploit the Nazi movement for the benefit of future generations of the Jewish people. Boy, as I got into these studies always, I'm wondering, since I'm a believer in karma, what karma binds the Germans and the Jews together? This is an amazing book. On page 82, Edwin Black writes, the Zionist organization then merely created the Jewish Agency for Palestine to function as the officially recognized administrative body. In reality, the Jewish Agency simply acted as an alter ego of the Zionist organization, coordinating most of its important policy decisions in advance with London. Thus, the Jewish Agency became the governmentally recognized half of what Herzl had earlier named the Society of Jews, the bargaining agent for the Jewish people. In the spring of 1933, the Jewish Agency began to do just that. And then on to chapter 8, the currency exemption. Bargaining in earnest with the Hitler regime began on March 16, 1933. Now, Hitler came to power January 30th, 1933. So that is the month of February. 6 weeks had gone by. Hitler had been in power for 6 weeks, all of 6 weeks, and hardly a Jew had been touched. And yet, already, they're saying that there is this dire problem and so on. However, behind the scenes, they were busily negotiating with Adolf Hitler. And of course, the one problem they had to overcome was the existing Reich currency restrictions, which forbade taking assets out of the country unless it was in the national interest. Page 83, he says, it was Felix Rosenblut who first suggested negotiating with the German government. Perhaps the government would allow a special concession allowing Jews to take the requisite equivalent of £1,000 if they emigrated to Palestine. And then he goes on down here discussing the nitty-gritty of this. Currency restrictions in Germany were indeed the barrier to an orderly transfer of the wealth of the citizens of Germany's Jewish middle class, enacted in August 1931 by the Brüning government, not by the Hitler government. At the height of the fiscal crisis, the currency restrictions prohibited anyone, Jew or Christian, German or foreigner, from taking currency out of Germany without permission. The restriction was not aimed at Jews, but as speculators and hoarders, but it now loomed as an unbridgeable obstacle to Jews immigrating to Palestine, especially since British entry regulations limited all categories of Jews except those in possessions of £1,000, about $5,000. The restriction ironically suited the German Zionists in Jerusalem, because it was precisely those Jews with enough money to qualify whom they wanted. As one German Zionist warned the Jewish agency, quote, "There is a danger that German Jews with money will go to other countries and those lacking means will come here. We must work on this matter," end of quote. Breaching the currency barrier required negotiation. A go-between was needed. He would need to be sympathetic to Zionism, but not directly associated with the Zionist movement. The man selected for this mission was a businessman called Sam Cohen. Few were undecided about Sam Cohen. In the minds of some of those he worked with or affected, Sam Cohen was an evil rogue, interested in no more than his own greed at the expense of his people. He was a traitor, a collaborator, a wealthy manipulator, a liar and a fraud, a schemer and a sower of seeker of influence, a man whose fortune bore the bloodstains of Jewish liberty and Jewish aspirations. To others who were closer, Sam Cohen was a munificent man of the Jewish cultural movement, a man who worked tirelessly, often selflessly, to help the Jewish people fight starvation, cultural dissolution, and national dispossession, a deeply religious man, a committed Zionist, a rescuer, a man whose contributions were often unseen but rarely unfelt, a little-known man whose immense importance to Israel deserved a special honored place in the saga of the Jewish people and their redemption. That's the man whom they chose to negotiate with Adolf Hitler's government. Each side used him for what it needed, devil or deliverer, yet few ever understood that Sam Cohen was in fact a little bit of both. And then they go into Cohen's background and say that he was born in the Polish industrial town of Lodz. And then they say after the war, still in his 20s, Cohen became a partner in a small Berlin bank, Louis Berndt and successors. He also gained control of a small coal mining operation in Upper Silesia. So Sam Cohen, they say, wasted little time. He arrived in Frankfurt in late March of 1933. Separate meetings were arranged with two senior government officials held over from the German imperial and Weimar days. Remember here, not Nazis. The first was with Hans Hartenstein, director of the Reich Foreign Currency Control Office. It was within his power to allocate foreign currency for uses in the national interest. The second meeting was with Hans Schmidt-Rölke, director of the Foreign Ministry's Eastern Desk, which had purview of the Middle East. Sam Cohen asked both officials for a special currency exemption for Jews agreeing to emigrate to Palestine. The Zionist movement would see to it that German exports were dramatically increased, thus earning additional foreign currency. Thus ends the second section of this transfer agreement story, which is the story of Nazi-Zionist collaboration in setting up what ultimately became the State of Israel. This is why there are some people saying Adolf Hitler was the unknown founder of the State of Israel. I am Ernst Zündel, speaking to you from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I reside at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1. Our telephone number here is 416-922-9850. 416-922-9850. Auf Wiedersehen.